Hey, it's me, Brian Reeves. Have you ever considered working with a coach? Like maybe you've achieved success on the outside, but deep fulfillment is still missing inside? Or you're confronted with a massive challenge or choice in your life? Or your relationships aren't as fulfilling as you want them to be? Or maybe you're just tired of trying to figure life out all by yourself? Well, I invite you to apply for private one-on-one coaching with me. Since 2012, I've helped 1,000 men and women like you break through hidden barriers, deepen their relationships, especially the relationship with themselves, and step more fully into the life they were meant to live. Coaching isn't about getting advice. It's about deep transformation so that you can really hear and trust the wisdom and clarity already always within you. I only take on a few clients at a time, and I only work with men and women truly ready to do the work. So if you're up for an inner adventure as a pathway to meaningful change in your outer world, go to brianreeves.com/coaching, click an application link on that page to apply. That's Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, reeves.com/coaching. The breakthrough you need could begin today. All right, let's get into today's episode.
Going back even before Freud, certainly before Jung, there was certainly an awareness in the 19th century that the F.W.H. Myers, for example, an awareness that that what is presented in personas of various kinds and, you know, what the ego knows and presents is just the tip of the iceberg. Most of what we are is underwater. We get inklings, we get impressions, but, you know, getting that up into consciousness is vital in the journey toward wholeness.
Welcome to Men This Way. I'm your host, Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, Reeves. I'm the author of 2 books and a professional relationship coach and men's coach since 2012. Alongside me as co-host is my lifelong best friend of over 40 years, Tate Arendt. And together we dive deep into the challenges and opportunities we're all facing in the world today. Here we have raw, unfiltered conversations about the topics that matter most to us, like intimacy, purpose, parenthood, spirituality, and much more. Our mission is to reveal the wisdom, insights, and practical tools to empower you to live your best life. All right, let's dive. Welcome, you both of you men. Before I even say anything about who our guest is, welcome, men.
Thank you.
We truly have an exciting episode for you today. I know I say that every episode, and I mean it. And today, though, I think we really have a special opportunity to talk with a man who, I'm going to just use the word legendary, Douglas M. Gillette. Yeah, right? Well, head nod. Yeah, let's go with it.
Okay.
Let's go with it. Okay. If you're a student of masculine archetypes, then you know this man, Douglas M. Gillette, as co-author of arguably one of the most influential books on masculine archetypes, King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, first published back in 1990. I've got that book. I've ordered so many copies over the years. I've got that book. I have it in my hand right here. It is marked up. It is my Bible. I have made love to that book. I have stared into its eyes. I've spent so much time with the material there, and we have Mr. Gillette in our $1 million studio today. Welcome, Douglas M. Gillette.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
We're honored to have you. Just a little background for our listeners who maybe haven't heard of your work. Douglas Gillette is a man accomplished across a variety of life disciplines. He's a lifelong student of, college teacher, guest lecturer, and workshop presenter in the fields of history of thought, cosmology, comparative religion, mythology, depth psychology. He's also a retired pastor now in the United Church of Christ, in which he specialized in interfaith dialogue. Doug, this short bio doesn't do your life justice. And I want to say, as I was perusing the internet, looking for your biographical information, and everywhere I found your bio, it was very poetically written and clearly by you. And I really love that. I love that because You know, when it comes to bios, rather than just see someone's stat sheet and list of accomplishments and credentials and all that, like I really enjoy, I personally love hearing how the poet inside experiences your life, your living, and you do that so beautifully. But the question we want to lead with is like, how do you introduce yourself at a dinner party when someone says, so what do you do?
That rarely occurs, but okay.
Yeah. Not at dinner parties or just?
Well, neither one. The dinner parties are always with my family. So okay.
They don't need the
intro. Yeah. All of the things you said. Also a student of the sciences. Well, you mentioned that, I think, too. I've published, actually, yesterday, the new book came out.
Oh, it's out. Congratulations.
Soul Making. Yeah. Which is a compilation. That sounds bad, but it is poetic, but it's a flowing account of my lifelong experiences with the unusual, the psychically unusual, psi phenomena to spiritual experiences. Got the comparative religion and the science and everything else in it. So that is my life, really. Well, no book is your life, but I have always searched for understanding of the origins of things, which accounts for my interest in depth psychology and you know, everything else, ancient civilizations, the foundations for spiritual experience, religions, and so on. So at 76, that journey is mostly completed, I think, although I published 8 books, three beyond the 5 books in the King, Warrior, Magician, Lover series, in various fields and topics. And I would say I am a lifelong student and a passionate teacher. And I'm always trying to help people, whether it's across gender lines, racial lines, ethnic lines, linguistic lines, religious, you know, I'm always trying to, contrary to the zeitgeist of the time we're living in, I have always been about trying to bring people together, celebrating their differences while affirming our commonality. And in fact, I sometimes say in my book discussion, I am doing ongoing book discussions on Zoom, I spent 20 years in the emeritus program teaching at Oakland College in Skokie, Illinois. And I continue that now through Zoom with book discussions. Right now we're doing Ancient Egypt, the history of Ancient Egypt. And then in January, we'll do probably 16 weeks of soul making.
How can people join those?
Email me.
Okay. What's your email?
It's lowercase Gillette, GILLETTED, as in Douglas, at sbcglobal.net.
Okay. Great. Great. All right. I'm sure many of our listeners will want to join that series. It sounds fascinating.
What I loved about your intro is the combination of the lifelong learner and passionate teacher. One of the conversations Brian and I were having yesterday is in today's culture, right? In the podcast world and the social media world, there are a lot of people that are setting themselves up as gurus in some ways, right?
And yeah.
Clearly, your lifelong work, gurus are never, they're done learning. Right. And yet you are still positioning that as and on the front end. And we're super excited to get into this conversation about soul making. And what I'm super curious about is to have a conversation with you just in the start about these masculine archetypes. You know, the name of our podcast, Men This Way, is born out of wanting to have the most important conversations with men and women, with people, about things that really matter. And your work in the archetype space, king, warrior, magician, lover, they are truly cultural touchstones for people exploring masculinity. And what I'm super curious to hear from your perspective is, why do you believe that this conversation, these archetypes, have had such a profound impact on men in the conversations?
I think because they do get at the structures and dynamics, the real structures and dynamics of the male psyche. I think they just immediately reverberate. And well, as we discussed the bipolar shadows of the archetypal expressions in their fullness, I think there's immediate identification with that. I hesitate to say that this thought reverberates because it's true, because I'm cautious about making truth claims, but in any field, there is something there that is true and is immediately recognizable.
Did you have any sense that when you all were writing this book, the impact that it was going to have?
No, we did not. It's interesting how that project started, because I had been at Chicago Theological Seminary, where Robert Moore was teaching. I decided to go there specifically because he was teaching there, because he was looking at Christianity and other religions through a Jungian lens. He began, I don't know what the year was, but I graduated from there in 1975, and he had been doing on the side some theorizing, and as well as in the field, men's work with Bill Kalth, Rich Tosi, those guys in the early days, and others. And he was my mentor in many ways. And I say this with complete humility, but I think it's the truth. I was his star student. So I was off, and he knew I could write. I was off in the Chicago area with my doing pastoring at my first church. Bob called me and said, "Doug, do you want to write a book?" And I said, "Okay, about what?" And so I said, you know, so then we got into, you know, talking about the four archetypes. And I'll never forget, we're sitting in a cafe in Hyde Park in Chicago. And I've been doing some research work with Bob's material and other people's material around men's work, because I wasn't really familiar with it, to tell you the truth. That may come as a bit of a startle, but I wasn't, having felt that I had accomplished a lot of what I needed to accomplish, before this even came up for us. But anyway, we're sitting at this table in the cafe, and we're going over our notes on things. I said, "You know what, Robert? I think the shadows that we're trying to ferret out here are bipolar." I said, "I think there's an aggressive angle or pole and a passive pole. And I think that is what is a large part of what's hanging men up." And there was just stunned silence. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I see that." And he drew a triangle form on the piece of paper. It said archetype in its fullness at the top, and then the poles of the shadow. And we were off. And I wrote a paragraph, just a paragraph, not a book proposal, just a paragraph, to Harper San Francisco, and said, "This is what Robert Moore and I would like to do." And the next thing there was a contract. And, I mean, that's unheard of, but I know what HarperCollins was trying to do. They were trying to compete with Iron John. So And it did compete well. I mean, Iron John still has sold more copies, I think, and so forth. But because Iron John gets at the mother complex specifically, as well as father issues. And, well, yeah, so that's how that got launched.
Well, just so you know, I've bought way more copies of King Warrior Magician Lover than Iron John personally.
Here's the difference. I think Iron John is a story with analysis. King Warrior Magician Lover is a system of thought, a whole system that you can use as a map. I'm not saying one is superior to the other in any way, two different approaches. It's the map like quality, I think, of King Warrior Magician Lover that is so helpful. Because you can track yourself, and with your therapist or analyst or in men's work, you can track, and other men can see kind of where you're at, how in the polarity of the shadow and shadows of these things and so forth.
Well, it's interesting because when we start doing archetype work for, you know, we take men through a year long deep dive men's group experience, Tate and I, every year. We've been doing that. This will be our fifth year upcoming, Elevate 2025. And when we get into the archetypes, what men often want to spend more time in is the shadows of those archetypes, the active or the passive aspects of those shadows. Because so many men, I think, are really caught in expressing those shadows, obviously unconsciously. We don't have language or even awareness of it. And so it is so eye-opening. It's so revealing. And I think it gives hope to men.
Yeah, because it makes sense. It's something that they can actually see as well as feel. And it takes them right into themselves. I think that's, you know, I am just thrilled, and I know Robert was too, not so much for the sales, although that's great too, but that it has reached so many men, and it is now part of the culture. It's part of the language of the culture, and as you say, podcasters and other things, it's just sort of everywhere. That you guys do a year-long thing, I think, I mean, sounds great, really great, really helpful, because just the weekend experience and then the eye groups, that's helpful, but you've got to, you got to stay at it.
Well, I just came from one of those weekend experiences. I staffed, you're talking about the Mankind Project work. Right,
yeah.
which largely is a fusion of Iron John, the Iron John story, and the King Warrior Magician Lover archetypes work. And I came from that. And it's a profound weekend. I went through that 10 years ago myself. It really launched me into this world of men's work. It wasn't quite right for me as an organization. I needed to branch off and do some other things, go a different path. But I went and staffed this weekend and it's truly profound, and it launches people into something. But I think, to your point, how they get held on the other side and then stewarded, it's like just the beginning. I find that, you know, in my studying of shadow work and Carl Jung's work, and what I've come to understand through that is it's really shadow work is about reclaiming our wholeness, right? Stepping into our wholeness. And I think one of the genius, I don't know, breakthrough is the right word, but one of the things that the triangle model of each of these archetypes, right? The archetype in its fullness, let's say, and then the shadow, the bipolar shadows of them, is it just in my own journey as a man growing up kind of paralyzed between, you know, I grew up with men, multiple men in my life that were in one pole or the other, in a sense, right? The aggressive tyrant energy or the weak, impotent,
right,
energy. And I was paralyzed as a man. I didn't know what, I knew neither one of those instinctively was a place I wanted to reside.
Right.
And yet in many ways, my journey through as a man and coming to, you know, what fullness looks like for me, not that I've arrived anywhere, but it's like been a fusion of those two, of those two energies.
Going back even before Freud, certainly before Jung, there was certainly an awareness in the 19th century that the F.W.H. Myers, for example, an awareness that that what is presented in personas of various kinds and, you know, what the ego knows and presents is just the tip of the iceberg. Most of what we are is underwater. We get inklings, we get impressions, but, you know, getting that up into consciousness is vital in the journey toward wholeness, because there is potential wholeness that is in all of us, that is under the waterline. We learn to fragment and repress and all that sort of thing from, it's partly natural. It's partly a natural process, I think, of being a finite being, to layer and repress. But it's also how we grew up and the traumas we were exposed to. That's the other part of the fragmentation and the layering. In other words, submergence into the shadow of aspects of ourselves which could have been helpful and life-enhancing for us if we'd had a different cultural, familial, et cetera, experience. So, and beyond the four archetypes, the shadows of which are under the water for most people, they're living them out, but they're living them out unconsciously. And so making as much as we can that is us split off is wholeness making. But then you go deeper and deeper. You're integrating these things through various exercises and, you know, techniques. You get to a certain point, though. It's not a certain point. It's a very indistinct sort of line, but you know when you've crossed it into the collective shadow, and that's where you better stop. Because it's way too much. It's way too dark for any ego to attempt to integrate.
The collective shadow, when we start mm-hmm. to, yeah. Can you briefly define, if you will, what do you mean by collective shadow?
Aspects of ourselves that no longer feel like they are in any way us. You can reach a point in analysis or therapy where you're integrating these altered personalities and fragments of personalities and so forth in the frame of the four archetypes. You're integrating the positive that the active side has and the positive that the negative side. The shadows in the personal unconscious certainly have gifts to give, and they are angry because they've been shoved out the door. But beneath them is, I'm a Jungian, right? So I do think he called it the collective unconscious. I call it the collective consciousness, because while we are unconscious of it, it is not unconscious of us. As you go down below, you know, and working with these pieces of oneself, you begin to encounter, and this is John O'Bear's work on multiple personalities, you begin to encounter, entities which no longer feel like they pertain to you.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of what that might look like for someone?
I talk about a lot of that in soul making, but they may be, they feel like they're outside. They're not outside of us. They're outside of ego consciousness and what it's been able to integrate of the personal unconscious. Demons, angels, apparitions, pressing presences, that don't feel like me? Yeah, I can give you specific examples, but you feel a certain alienness, or that you're leaving the strictly human realm.
One thing that I love that you're pointing at, one thing that I've learned about Carl Jung's work as I've been studying it more lately, is he was, I think what made him so revolutionary, one of the things is that, like, he didn't ignore anything that was in that was in the realm of human experience. Like you say, angels, demons, ghosts, aliens, all, whereas a lot of the psychologists of his day just dismissed such phenomenon as just silliness, not to be paid attention to. What I understand what he looked at was, no, if human consciousness is beholding these things, is telling these stories, it's not relevant whether or not they're absolutely true in the sense that they exist in and of themselves, but they exist in the human psyche. They're there, they're present.
They're psychological facts.
Right. Because we're talking about them. We're giving them language.
In my experience, they're not just vague. I mean, they can be, but they're not just vague, a sense of presence. They are, and I would say from our perspective in the narrow band of awareness that we have, that is pretty well, as you said, fenced in by modernity, the Enlightenment, rationality, scientism, etc., which I'm not talking against. I'm just saying it doesn't go far enough. It's very useful. It's very, but it is shorthand for reality, capital R. It's true that people brought up in modernity, and if we got modern for good reasons, I mean, honestly, they dismiss what one of my spiritual heroes, a Muslim Sufi medieval Ibn al-Arabi, called the imaginal. It's not imaginary in the sense of fantasy. It's imaginal. In other words, it requires the imagination, which is a faculty that strides worlds, this world and others. It requires imagination to be able to experience, encounter, and make friends with where you can, and where you can't, dismiss or leave. For me, it's like this issue of what's rational, modern, etc., versus what seems to be irrational. By the way, I don't think it is irrational, these presences and entities and layers of reality. You ever see the movie, it's an old movie now, like me, The Conquest of Paradise? It's about Columbus's expedition, his first expedition to the Americas. And he's trying to get funding from the Spanish treasury, right, to launch his three little boats. And he's standing on a balcony with the finance minister of Spain. And the finance minister is resisting spending this money for the expedition. And Columbus finally grabs him by the shoulder and turns him to look out across the city. I forget which city they're in, but in Spain. And he says to him, "What do you see?" And the finance minister says, "I see towers, I see houses, I see public buildings, I see churches." And Columbus says, "Right. Those all came from the imagination. It was people like me," like Columbus says, like him, "that do the imagining. And you guys do the building. That's fine. Give me the money." But the point is, there's the conflict right there between modernity, which is supposed to be hard-headed and so forth. But modernity couldn't exist if it weren't for the imaginal that lies beneath it. And when I was doing life guiding, life coaching, whatever you want to call it now, for many years, I could tell, maybe you guys can too, with my clients, how functional their imaginations were. Because doing Jungian work in general, or many different schools of psychology, and particularly thinking about men's work, you have success to the degree that A, you're willing to do the work, but B, you have a healthy functioning imagination. You cannot access these fragmented, broken off aspects of yourselves without imagination.
So much of the work, you know, as you're saying that. So one of the practices that I've used over the years is working with psilocybin mushrooms. And because it gives me access to something, you know, my background is military, just being a boy in this culture, so disconnected from my body, from my intuition, my emotions, just disconnected from self. And, you know, in psilocybin mushroom journeys, something gets activated. I'll do a couple of those a year is really good for me. Something gets activated and some of my best ideas that, by the way, are alive right now, this podcast even, this work, this Men This Way, the title of this podcast, so much of the men's work came from, you know, psilocybin mushroom journey where it just talk about being in the imaginal, right? And then here it is. So I'm that really lands.
Yeah, because it makes our repression barriers more porous. It allows the collective consciousness to come up through the personal unconscious into, you know, the quote unquote daylight world of common sense, you know, pay the mortgage, make the car payment, raise, you know, that world. And it just shows you there is so much more, not just to reality, but to each of us.
Yeah.
And it is those different registers of consciousness, of who I am, that ultimately I think have a very practical value, not that they need to have, but they do have. And that is a greater sense of the range of what I am makes the part of me that is, you know, daily life, commonsensical, rationally accessible, more humble. And to become more humble is to become more compassionate, which is to become more humane. And as far as we can, under the conditions of existence, and leads to clearer and purer moments of love. I know that sounds corny, maybe, but to me, that's the ultimate goal.
Well, it's the core of my purpose in life is to serve love, ultimately. So that's a rabbit hole we could go down to, but I know, Tate, we want to...
Well, yeah, I think this is just such a profound conversation, especially you use this word love, and we're having this conversation about masculinity. You know, in today's world, there are a lot of conversations about masculinity that are both complex and contentious. You wrote a book that not only has staying power, but modern day relevance, right? You wrote the book 30 plus years ago. And so what I'm curious to hear from you about is, how do you see that book's relevance evolving to meet the moment that we're now in as we have this conversation about masculinity and men's work?
I think it has staying power and is relevant today because, again, it lays out a structure and a set of dynamics, which just simply is true and resonates. There's a lot of, and I'm not putting it down, it's just that there's lots of transient kind of discussion that will fade it'll be in the mode of the moment, and then it will pass. If you're pointing out and offering something that does not change, you know, the social structures of masculinity, femininity, men and women, which aren't the same thing as masculinity, femininity, exactly. We in the West, in particular, have a very, whether people like to think of it like this or not, we have a very experimental, tentative view of reality and our reality. So we experiment with these different configurations of society and gender and so forth. And, you know, those experiments are all good, but they're largely done unconsciously, in my view, without conscious enough attention to, well, again, structures and dynamics. It is not true, in my view, that we are tabulas rasas, that we're born blank slates, or that we're interchangeable parts, or that our temperaments are identical, whether that's when the men, women, other genders. We are born with, I mean, the evidence is just, if you have kids, you know, you know that that's true.
Yeah, my mom said the same thing. You know, three children. She said, Brian, all three of you, at 1 year old, I could see who you were going to be at 4 years.
Yeah, yeah. And you're born that way. You know, whether that's genes, I think it's a combination of genes and I would call it spiritual influences. Or psychic influences on what you're going to, who you're going to be. But I think we can have all these different experiments, which are good, although a lot of people get hurt in the experimentation. As society tries this, then it tries that, then it tries this and that. But the staying power of King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, I think, which can be translated into, you know, as an underlying structure for women too, with a different flavor or a different tonal quality, but the same structure, because we are human beings and we're all human beings and we're all each other in some deep way. I hope I answered your question to some extent, Tate.
Yeah, it's a, you know, that's one of the conversations that Brian and I often have with men is that in a world where there are a whole lot, we use this term, a whole lot of olders and not a lot of elders, the maps have not been shown to us. We don't know necessarily where to go. We don't know which paths to follow to give us the freedom and the connection that we're looking for in this life. And so, you know, that adage of what happens in life is that we paint our faces pretending like we know what we're doing. And end up leaving a trail of tears behind for the people that love us and we love the most. And it's not because we don't want to do better. It's because we don't know how to
don't
do
know
better.
How. Yeah.
And it's the maps that get presented in the world. It's why, you know, Brian and I built both a year-long program and a six-month coaching program that the foundation of which is a map for men to follow so that they can wake up to where are they and where do they want to go and what are the steps that they can take in order to come online in ways that they've been dying to come online.
Right, right. And I think that is particularly, I mean, it's always been true, at least once we got out of the hunter-gatherer communities and so forth, not that human beings haven't always been complex, but we certainly have complexified our understandings of ourselves and reality through the epochs of civilization and so forth. A lot of younger men now, I know this is true from our daughter's dating life. She's now married. But she's only 28 and I'm 76. My wife is 53. So I'm actually her grandfather by age and the great grandfather of our granddaughter by age. But the point is that through her friends and she herself And then watching the nightly news, which I'm trying to do less of now because it's so awful. But I see the lostness in men, at least in our society. And I have to believe that's true for a lot of societies. Once you reach a certain point in complexity, whatever, things start becoming too much. And many young men, and I take it many young middle-aged men, feel pushed off stage, left behind, ignored, disparaged, and they really need to feel valuable again and important. And that takes another, part of that is another look at social engineering to re-include men, but it also takes this psycho-spiritual journey that King, Warrior, Magician, Lover offers.
Something that I've learned, your assistant shared with me that you really enjoy talking about, and I think is at the core of what we're also talking about and exploring here, is integrating the whole man.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? I mean, it sounds great as an idea. I'd love to integrate the whole man. I don't know, but what does that mean to you?
To me, it means at one level, because I think everything is layered and leveled. At one level, it is the work that's been called men's work, which, and specifically in MKP and take your program, it means getting the split off aspects of ourselves. And, some of that split off is not just the shadow polarity. It's also the archetype in its fullness, seldom experienced.
Yeah, that's right.
I might say.
Yeah.
Getting all these characters together around the table with the ego as, with some caveats, but with the ego as the CEO.
Yeah.
And having these guys under the, certainly not tyranny of, but under the guidance of the ego, talk to each other and to the, literally, this is where imagination comes in again. You can't do this if you don't have a thriving imagination. And you guys, we all more or less agree on things. Okay. Yes, I need you for that. And I really, just the way we do in personal relationships. These are personal relationships within each of us. So there is that, integrating the masculine aspects. It's also bringing the anima to the table when we're talking about men's work. Drew and I are talking about, we're doing a lot of work around this and thinking about a new book. What is the fifth archetype that needs to be included? Jung was always looking for the missing fourth. We're looking for the missing fifth. And I'm convinced that it is the feminine, the anima within us, which we can't even begin to understand unless we've done some other work. As I say, father issues is one thing, and very painful. Mother work is essential to freeing a man from vulnerability to an unhappy, even dangerous feminine, which is within the anima too, the interjected mother, freeing him to be a full man who is not only not afraid of or resentful of the feminine, but inclusive of it on good terms. So that's wholeness at an individual level. And it's what I think is the missing fifth archetype.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a chapter that I wrote. I have a book called Choose Her Every Day or Leave Her. And there's a chapter in that book titled, You Can't Be King Until You Embrace the Feminine.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know, I wouldn't have known to put it in the terms that you're putting it in. It's sort of my own intuitive awakening and just looking around and looking at my own life and going, okay, and seeing, and I was actually using a movie, King Arthur, as my muse for that essay, because it's ultimately, it's the feminine that brings this boy, this young boy, this man who is stuck in adolescence.
Yeah.
It is these female or feminine figures, the sorceress, that force him ultimately to step into a mature, responsible manhood. And
I think men have always been a little short on the realization that the feminine is not, I mean, we do have the gender wars and that's always been, but the feminine does not have to be experienced as overwhelming, overpowering, the devouring mother. If you're in love with the inner feminine and she's in love with you, wow. You know, that's really empowering. And women then are no longer objects of dread. And so there's that. It doesn't make the man more feminine, you know, which a lot of men worry about. It makes you more masculine, actually.
Yeah, too. We have this, and we talk about the skill of being able to ignite erotic tension, which is really about being able to hold both masculine and feminine energy and being able to dance inside of that. If you as a man don't have access to the feminine energy that's inside of you, you don't have the range that's dynamic and interesting to be able to capture a modern day woman, right?
Right.
And so it is this, the paradox of the masculine and feminine. And one of the things that I was curious to ask you about in your new book, Soulmaking, you say that it explains how to embrace the paradox of the spiritual path. So can you speak to what is that paradox that you're referring to?
First of all, let me say, as I say in the book, I don't know what reality is. I don't know anyone who does. Okay.
I know people who think they know.
The Tao that is spoken is not the true Tao. Cliche, but you know, acknowledgement of built-in ignorance. But the core paradox that I think from experiences I've had of being myself here, struggling along with life, almost and simultaneously, actually. Experienced kind of consecutively, but really understood to be simultaneous, being above, transcendent, in a different register of Doug that is hugely expansive and full and talk about whole and immortal eternal, which means, among other things to me, beyond time and space, wherever and whatever that is exactly, but a higher, let's just say a higher register in which I am whole. And then there's me down here struggling along sequentially. The paradox is that we already are what we're trying to become. We already are that. Not in our usual awareness here, but elsewhere. I think of Plato's time is the moving image of eternity. Space, he didn't say this part, space is the explication of the infinite.
What you're saying there, they're almost like Zen koans in a way. Time is the moving image of eternity. Oh, I'm gonna sit with that on my next psilocybin journey and
yeah,
that one.
Yeah, so you know, so then I asked the question in Soulmaking and in some of my other books too, in a different way, but this really focuses on that. How can that be? I mean, what is this? That we already are what we're trying to become. Why are we trying to become it then? Because time is the moving image of eternity, because we've been thrown into time-space, space-time, for whatever reasons. Ask me why. I don't know. But I do have the sense, and that I've read a lot of thinkers who have tried to understand this, and nobody that I've found can give me a real rationale for it, or a true enough or full enough. But I just live with it now. It's like, okay. But that is the core paradox, I think. We already are what we're becoming.
Yeah, I know you also talk about transcendence in your book. Maybe there's a through line here, but share with us, what do you mean by transcendence? How do you define that? And is there a connection to what the conversation we're having right now?
There is, in the sense that, in many probably senses, but we're talking about wholeness and bringing the parts of ourselves split off, unwanted, unloved, back into love and cooperative, you know, community, enmeshing really
not
with each other.
Not to be exiled.
Not to be exiled at all. And then the fifth archetype, I think, bringing in the feminine. And of course, she has multiple expressions too within each of us. But transcendence is at least getting that done, and then having experiences, psilocybin induced or other experiences of these other layers and registers of who we are. Once I feel some of that, I am able. It's not that I'm able. I mean, I don't will it. I don't wish it. I don't try. You know, it just happens. I feel lifted up. Here's another paradox that's part of this, I think. I feel I'm still me. There's an I here that I'm still aware of, but it's above. It rises above all of, you know, the stuff I'm trying to do down here. There's some sayings that have helped me a lot with lowering my anxiety about trying to become whole here in this little band of reality. One is a friend of mine who died a number of years ago, Don Jones. You might know his name or not. Okay. He was a big honcho and MKP for a number of years. But he said to me one time, he said, "Doug, not everything we're doing here is meant for here. And so where is it meant for?" That helps me feel that you know, okay, so there's something beyond, there's something above I'm transcending toward. And then Van Gogh, roughly paraphrasing a biblical phrase, said, "This world is for sowing. The harvest is not here."
I think about, you know, what you're pointing at, Doug, a lot. You know, I love the work that Tate and I are doing. I love the work that we're doing. It's the work of my soul. I dreamed a long time of being where I am today with an amazing wife that I have, you know, the relationship that I have 9 years with my wife, and good work. I got a good dog, doing this with my childhood best friend of 40 years, Tate. And there are days where it just feels like a slog.
Oh yeah.
And it's hard. And, you know, I've got my backup plans that are like my escape routes.
Right.
When shit goes sideways, that's the backup plan, you know, and knowing too that this work will never be complete. There's no completion to this. There's no destination we'll arrive at. You know, I kind of laugh sometimes at people that they have this thing in their mission statement. We're going to impact, you know, 1 billion people by, you know, this year, next year. I don't know. That's fine. But there's a bit of a hubris in that, I suppose. And I think I what brings me often comfort, and I get what you're saying. Like, there's a part of me, there's this I don't know, higher self, just, I don't know, maybe divine part of me, the divine aspect of me that sort of hovers above it all and sort of, you know, looks down and has this voice that says, yeah, keep going, do your part, do what you're doing. It's going to fail in the biggest ways that where you think it'll succeed. You know, that the arrogance of how you think you're going, what you're up to, put that to the side. Just keep doing what you're doing and so on.
I want to say something just based on what you just said. Keep doing what you're doing. We took my mother in to live with us her last 3 years in Miami. We were in Miami. And we cared for her until she died toward early morning one day. 2 mornings later, I woke up and she was in the crematorium. They were getting, you know, ready to, her body was. And I woke up, that beautiful Miami sunlight, which will be underwater one of these days. But anyway, yeah. And it was still above water. But the room was filled with light, but it wasn't just the sunlight. I could tell that. It was light beyond light, the source of light. And up near the left-hand corner of the bedroom, near the ceiling, I heard my mother's voice. And she said, and it's not something she would have said in life. And it was had a little bit different tone, but it was her voice. And she said, Douglas, it's so beautiful over here. Keep doing what you're doing. Was what you just said, Brian. And it's like, okay. I mean, my mother had never talked to me that way in life. When Robert and I sold our first book, and I told my mother, yeah, we sold a book. She said, Douglas, that's impossible. Dreams don't come true. Oh, God. And there's part of the family myth there, you know, but this was a different mother, you know, speaking to me from the corner of the room than
you know,
that one.
This will sound, I don't know if morbid's the right word, but part of me is looking forward to my father dying because I know I'm going to have a much better relationship with him. when I have his Obi-Wan Kenobi soul,
right?
You know,
right. Yeah, no, I understand what you mean.
Yeah.
And the thing that I was going to reference, and somebody will need to fact check me on this, but I understand if you take from the time that the Big Bang happened, and you take chronologically when that happened, and the creation of the solar systems and our solar system and then our earth, or our sun and then our earth, and you bring that down. And if you were to condense all of that time into a year's existence, that the human experience is like the last 3 seconds of newborns. And so you talk about the vastness of creation, and here we are, we sell a book or we launch a program or we get married or we have a kid, or the existence of that, which you can look at that in two different ways, which is we are nothing or wow, what an existence, a space and time that we showed up here on this earth, and we get to do whatever it is that we're here to do for as much time as we have. And to figure out how we can have not just success, but significance in the moments that we're actually here with the people that we're actually here to do life with.
And for me, what you just said, for me, and that's also in soul making, for me, it doesn't matter how big this particular universe is, how old it is, how much longer it will go on, what its ultimate fate is, if it's got to disperse and diffuse and become not life and sentience supporting. It's this moment. This is why it is. All of it is for this. And there isn't anything, in my view, in the vastness of the space and time of this particular universe, there isn't anything in it that compares to the communicated love between anybody. But where I, and I'm not saying this to the exclusion of other people that I love and love me, but I was the daytime caregiver for our granddaughter from 3 months to 13 months. I took her from baby to little girl. And the love that we, with that kind of innocence that babies have, the love that we could share and pass, are you kidding me? Is there anything like that? How does the universe compare with that? That's the reason for the universe.
Douglas, you know, on that note, I saw Prince, the artist Prince, perform at a small club in LA a couple of years ago, like 300 people. It was such a remarkable moment in my life as Prince, you know, legendary man who'd brought so much to my life. And reflecting on the concert, like he could have just walked out on the stage and honestly taken a dump on the stage and we would have all applauded and be like, dude, best thing I've ever seen. That like he, and I don't, it's a weird segue into just saying that this is so precious for us to be able to sit with you and talk with you. I know that Tate and I, we could talk with you for hours, days. I know you're having conversations with people through your that online platform, through the discussions that you're having around your book. Remind me again how people can first buy your book and attend those lectures.
Well, the book is out now. I mean, you could always pre-order it. It is beginning to show up in stores today, if not earlier. But you can order it from everywhere. Simon & Schuster, Inner Traditions, Amazon, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And a bunch of discount. It's everywhere. Great. So, okay. Yeah.
Do you have an audiobook version?
Not yet.
Not yet, but you plan not, on it?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do. The publisher, that's up to the publisher. And because they hold those, you know, secondary rights. It's brand new. I mean, we're just going to see, you know, shove it up there, give it a little lift and see if it'll take off. But no, unfortunately, the Audible or audio version, I don't know. Maybe if the book does really well, they'll decide to do that soon, you know?
Right. Well, I think there's something about hearing this type of material, especially someone like you who's been steeped in this work for, you know, to hear that in the wisdom of your voice, I think would be really magical. So hopefully that gets to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Before I'm 80.
Before you can't see what you're reading anymore.
Yeah. Before I can't see what I'm reading or have much of a voice. But, and again, I know it's risky, but I want to do it anyhow. And that is, go to my email. I don't want really 5,000 emails a day, but you know, do what I can with it and say specifically that you're interested in, because I just can't have conversations with everybody. You know, I tried that for a while. It was totally impossible. And it's not because I reject them I just can't. But email me and express interest in Doug's book discussion group.
Great. Okay. And I want to underscore for everyone, please do not expect a response if you email.
Yeah. Unless you do that one. If you do that one, you know, I will respond. And the person that runs these things for me, Maureen will respond to that.
Perfect. And that email address one more time.
GILLETTED at sbcglobal.net.
Great. Final question for you. And maybe I'm asking the impossible, but if there's one message or idea, your work spans disciplines, themes, lifetimes even. Yeah, but if there's one message or idea that you would want people to take away from your life's work, what would that be?
Humaneness. all that's involved, you know, humility, wonder, awe, terror, joy, gratitude, love, humility, humaneness.
Certainly a message that our time needs.
Yes.
To heed at our, and we ignore at our own peril.
Yeah. Doug, thank you for being an elder, a true, true elder. We are so enormously grateful.
Yeah, thank truly. You. Thank you. Keep doing what you're doing. This is great. This was wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you. This time has been precious. Thank you so much, sir. We're out here carrying your work forward.